for those of you who haven't been to Monday nights before, or even those of you that have, what we do is, in the second half of the class, in a seminar, we have in a seminar style, so whoever's leading talks for a bit, and then there's a chance for discussion and questions. And we usually pick themes that last for 6 or 8 or 10 weeks. And tonight we're starting a new theme. So what I'll do is I'll just introduce the theme and then I'll sort of launch in. So the theme for the next wee while, well, the theme is a person. And the person is someone called Sangharakshita. So you might have heard the name of Sangharakshita, you might not have. So I'm going to just say a little bit about who is Sangharakshita and why the theme is Sangharakshita. So Sangharakshita was born in 1925, and he was born in England in a working class family in Tooting. And at the age of, I think it was 16 or 18, he went into a second-hand bookshop, found an ancient Buddhist text, and just opened it and had, well, a kind of epiphany, really, because when he read that Buddhist text, he realised that he was a Buddhist and that he always had been. He felt he knew he was a Buddhist and that he always had been. He certainly hadn't been brought up a Buddhist, not in working class Tooting in 1925. I don't know if anybody would have been brought up a Buddhist then in this country. So he realised he was a Buddhist, and he started even at that young age to further his studies in Buddhism. The war broke out. He was posted to India as a signals operator. That was quite handy in a way, because at the end of the war, he just stayed in India, the country of the Buddha, was ordained as a monk, had all sorts of adventures, stayed many years there, and was taught by very many great teachers in India, but also teachers who were coming, who were fleeing from Tibet and coming through the mountains. So he was taught by Tibetan teachers as well, and was quite happily there, living, well, the kind of life of a sort of semi-hermit, really, meditating and doing some teaching, but spent a lot of his time meditating and writing about Buddhism. And then, by chance would have it, he came to England, back to England, and he, for one reason or another, decided to stay and decided that what was needed in England was a new Buddhist movement. There was by this time in England, in Britain, well, I don't know if it was in the whole of Britain, but certainly in England, there was some Buddhism, but to his mind it was rather academic. And he thought, well, what is needed is a new movement where Buddhism is something that has lived. And so he founded a new Buddhist movement. And that movement is the movement that we are part of, that the LBC is part of. And that movement is now called Tri Ratna. At first it was called the Western Buddhist Order, but now it's called Tri Ratna. So Sangharakshita was the founder of the movement that we are part of. You could quite accurately say that without Sangharakshita, none of us would be sitting here in this building, because it wouldn't be here. So Sangharakshita, as I said, was born in 1925. So if you're even a tiny bit good at arithmetic, you'll realise it's not soon going to be his 90th birthday. So it's going to be his 90th birthday on the 26th of August. And we're celebrating that in gratitude to Sangharakshita. So what we've decided to do for the next few weeks is each of us that are teachers on the class are just choosing our favourite teaching of Sangharakshita. He's got many, many writings, many, many lectures. We're just going to choose one of the ones that's spoken to us and share that with you. And we hope that whatever your connection with Sangharakshita is, even if the tonight is the first time you've ever heard the name of Sangharakshita, that will be of some interest and hopefully some benefit. So for those of us that are members of the order, that's those of us wearing these kesas, we call them, Sangharakshita is our teacher. Teacher makes it sound a bit too clinical almost. One way you could put that, speaking poetically, is that there's a mutual resonance between the way Sangharakshita experiences going for refuge, placing one's heart upon the three jewels of Buddhism, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and our own. Yeah, that there's a mutual resonance, that something vibrates. There's a sort of mutual vibration between that understanding and Sangharakshita. That's why we've chosen to join this order, and that's why we've been, as it were, accepted into this order, because there's that mutual resonance. So for those of us in the order, there's a very, very strong and powerful relationship. Some people are what's called mitras in this room. Mitra means friend. For people that are mitras, there's some, they'll certainly have heard the name of Sangharakshita and be responding in some way to the particular form that Buddhism takes in Sri Ratna. Of course, there's very, very many Buddhist movements in the West now. It's changed a lot in the past 50 or so years. So people who have become what we call mitras are saying and feeling they don't just feel they're a Buddhist, but they feel that they want to practice within this particular expression of Buddhism with its particular emphasis and particular set of practices. But yes, of course, some of you might never have heard the name of Sangharakshita at all, might even be a bit wary of this idea of there's this sort of figurehead, as it were. That's kind of fine and almost kind of quite intelligent. You want to sort of test this out, don't you? But what I would say is, I think even if you've never heard of Sangharakshita before, how you could think of Sangharakshita as someone who is a new Buddhist, who is someone who wasn't born a Buddhist. Buddhism wasn't just something he was born into, the way, you know, for myself, I was born into a Catholic family, so I was just baptized and I was just a Catholic until I decided otherwise. So Sangharakshita was never an ethnic Buddhist in that way. So when I say new Buddhist, he was someone who, as a conscious adult, young adult but still adult, discovered the teachings of Buddhism, felt a resonance and wanted to follow them, and wanted to, particularly when he came back to the West, see, well, how can you practice Buddhism, this ancient teaching, in the West? I think that even in its own right, to me, that's very interesting, and that I'm hoping that will interest you, that we're going to be sharing these teachings with. How do you, as a someone who hasn't been born into Buddhism, how do you make these teachings something that's vibrant and alive for yourself? And that applies even if you, in a sense, have been born into a Buddhist culture. It's still what we teach at this centre, is even if you have been born either into a Buddhist culture or into a Buddhist family, say your parents have been Buddhist, it's still important to make that choice for yourself. That really being a Buddhist is something that you have to have the freedom not to be, if you see what I mean, to be. That you make that choice yourself, and that's what Sangharakshita did. So that's a particular point I'm emphasising tonight. So even if it's the first time you've ever heard the name of this man, you can think of this man as someone who made that discovery himself and then tried to think it all through and think, well, what does this mean in this day and age? And probably even for those of us that have known of Sangharakshita for a long time, it's worth even still reflecting on that. Okay, so that's by way of our introduction to the whole series. And as I say, each of us is going to be choosing one particular teaching and then expanding on that. And what I've chosen as my teaching is a poem. So in a moment or two, I'm going to be reading you a poem written by Sangharakshita, and then hopefully drawing out, well, just some of the what I think is the relevance of this and what can be the relevance of this to our own spiritual lives, to our own Dharma lives. Okay, so before I do that, I want to just go back to last week, which some of you were here, and something that was said in one of the talks that we had last week. So we had a very special evening last week. What we had was three women who had just been ordained, and they came back from their ordination and they were sharing something of the experience of that. They had been ordained in the context of a three-month retreat. So that was interesting in itself. Here's three people just freshly back from a three-month retreat. Kind of wow in a way. What's that like? I've done it once myself, but not many people get the chance to do that. So we had these three women talking about being on this three-month retreat, and in the context of that, they had their ordination. And one of them was saying one of the things she valued most about that three-month retreat was this, and it was a little bit like Akasha Mitra was touching on in his announcement. She said that in her London life, it can often feel like her Dharma practice, her Buddhist practice, is something that's just got to be fitted into her life. Yeah? There's all her life, her work, her home life and everything. And then, that's all this. And then she says, like her Buddhist practice, she tries to fit that in. Yeah, she tries to fit that in. But on the retreat, she said it was like that completely turned around. So she had, you had 3 whole months where, well, the Dharma practice, whether that was formally sitting in meditation or just simply like going for walks, communicating with people, the practice of spiritual friendship, that in a way, that was the overarching thing. And all the sort of duties and, you know, doing the cooking and washing up and everything was within the context of feeling very, very strongly this overarching sense of Dharma practice. And that had struck her very strongly. And she was talking about that. And while she was talking, it was striking me strongly because I was thinking, that's great that that can happen on retreat. But really, wouldn't it be great if that was, you know, I was thinking for my own life, well, wouldn't that be great if that was just what my life was like? Rather than trying to fit my practice into my life, something happens that's much more unified. And so then it was interesting because I thought, well, why not? You know, what stops me? And because if one really did that to completion, then in a sense you'd sort of be enlightened on the spot. So what I've started to get interested in what bits of my life am I keeping as a separate little compartment? Yeah, what bits of my life are keeping a separate little compartment? I've got a kind of Dharma life here and this separate compartment here. So I started to think about that, and interestingly enough, at the beginning of his Dharma life, this was something that Sangharakshita really, really grappled with himself very, very intensely, and that's what I want to unfold in the rest of the me speaking. As I say, there'll be a chance for you to join in after a little while. So Sangharakshita talks in his very early Buddhist life, so this is in his early 20s, of these kind of quite distinct parts of himself that, yeah, almost felt quite separate, so much so that he calls them, in retrospect, Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2. He wasn't called Sangharakshita then, but looking back, he calls them that. And what he calls Sangharakshita 1 was the part of him that wanted to get up early, do his meditation, do his Dharma study, kind of be quite sort of, yeah, just quite disciplined and quite kind of quite kind of on it, really, in a way, just on, you know, really doing it in a sense. So that's what he called Sangharakshita 1. Sangharakshita 2, he called that part of himself that wanted to not get up early, stay in bed, sort of dream, write poetry, look at art, you know, have meaningful, you know, communicate with other people, yeah? So he called that Sangharakshita too. So he felt that these were in conflict, yeah? He felt that he didn't know how to, he didn't think there could be a way of joining them up, yeah? So it was like, you might call his spiritual vision on one side, that was Sangharakshita 1, and then this, his artistic vision, the side that wanted to be more free, more, maybe more playful, more passionate, more responding to the beauty of his inner life and the world around, you know, he felt that as separate, yeah? Or another way to put it, he felt that, you know, I was thinking there was the disciplinarian and then the dreamer, or the sort of part that was really wanted to be sort of useful and doing good in the world, against a part that wanted to be, well, in a sense, sort of useless, not having to have a sort of a use in a way, just wanted to have that freedom. So he called them Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2 in retrospect. Does that resonate with anyone, these different sides, that a few nods that one might have? It might express itself in different ways, but you know, sometimes I hear people saying, oh, I just want to go up a mountain and just meditate for like 6 months and then I'll be enlightened. And then they kind of think, oh, but what about, you know, and then there's another side that in a sense doesn't want to do that. But it might express itself in different ways. You were saying, does that resonate, Katrine, with you? Would you like to say any more about that, or...?
I very much resonate with the sort of Sangharakshita 1 and 2. Kind of the side of me that is quite ambitious and wants to do a lot of good. Kind of pushing myself in the society that just kind of, which usually only really awakens fully in retreat.
Yeah.
Which is very, very different. And I find it's quite difficult to integrate my retreat self in my daily life. My daily life is very much dominated by the, you know, quite vicious or sort of
So that's interesting, isn't it? You feel that's a real felt experience. So I mean, to me, it's quite helpful to me to realise that even someone, you know, who had that strong a response to Buddhism. And who, well, you know, at that time he hadn't been practicing so long, but now he's been practicing for so long, could still talk in those terms, yeah? So there's very, in his life, there's very big conflict, and, you know, it was a real fight, and he talks about how the conflict got so intense between Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2 that one day he just burned all his poems. Yeah, one day, just like Sangharakshita 1 got so annoyed with the Sangharakshita 2 who wanted to write a big long poem, they just burned all the poems. And then that was a shock. You know, that was a shock to his system. He said it was a shock to, in a way, both Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2 that happened, a dramatic moment. It was only, he said, the reconciliation started to happen. He was in India by this time, and the war had ended, and he was teaching some students, just to kind of make a living. He was teaching some students, some Indian students, English literature. They were probably delighted to have this Englishman teach them English literature. He was teaching them some Shelley, the poet Shelley. And he suddenly had an insight when he was teaching the poems of Shelley. He realised, this is not actually dissimilar to teaching the Dharma, to teaching Buddhism or to teaching meditation. And what he said about this, I wrote it down, he said, "The greatest poetry touches the depths of the human heart and therefore begins to meet the Dharma." So that was him starting to realise that there possibly didn't need to be such a separation. And he himself wrote a little poem about this, which I'm going to read you. It'll just take me a minute to switch this on. So, he wrote a few lines about this. So this is what he wrote. He wrote, "I questioned in my greener age whether it were best for me to blossom poet or burgeon sage. But now in riper days I see, and with what gladness know it, the poet is the truest sage the sweetest poet, the piper his own best tune, and laugh that I could ever have striven thus to sever the moonlight from the moon." So I'm very, very fond of this image of you can't sever the moonlight from the moon. And it also tickles me that he talks about now in riper days I see, because he was writing this at the grand age of 26. So in a way, the simple little poem, and it's kind of, you know, it's sort of the coming together of these. I'm very fond of those last couple of lines of not being able to separate the moonlight from the moon. And I think it's interesting to me, and I hope it might touch something in you, that he's chosen the image of the moon at all. I mean, he could have said the sunlight from the sun, the lamplight from the lamp, but he said the moonlight from the moon. And I thought we might, there might be something in that itself that kind of helps us to sort of explore this theme, or the theme that I'm hoping to unfold. So I thought I might just pause there and ask you, well, what do you associate with the moon? Why might moonlight be the image in this poem? So you can just say any associations with the moon. You don't have to be dharmic or anything. Maybe pretend there's the moon and there's the sun, isn't there? But what do you associate with the moon?
Reflecting the sun's light.
So it's reflected light, yeah, and it's the sun's light, yeah. Yeah.
There's something more lyrical about the moon.
Something more?
Lyrical.
Ah.
Mysterious.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, 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 that's what I was thinking, yeah.
And I think also when I think of like the moon and the moonlight, I think of like laying in the field and looking up at the moon and kind of like pondering. And I think that sort of it goes along with his sort of like looking back and his whole questioning of like life. These different sides. And I guess also in a way the sun, it's like there's almost more purpose in the sun, and then it gives us like energy and like makes things grow, and the moon is like this nice thing to look at, but it doesn't have as clear of a direct purpose in our life. So I don't know, in some way that kind of is like makes me question these different sides, and I'm always like, oh, which one's better, which one should I listen to? But there's this kind of neither's really better in living in like harmony, and I think that's more embodied in like the moon than the sun, perhaps.
Well, there's a lot in that. There's the atmosphere of the moon and the pondering, And then, well, that's very interesting. You're saying about the purposelessness, which we'll come back to. And just in a way, you don't say explicitly, but actually even that we can look at the moon, you know, because we can't, you know, we can't look directly at the sun, can we? But we can look at the moon. So again, that's a, that I think I want to draw something out about that. So yes, Dr. Badger.
Yeah, I'd like to make a point that comes into that. It's a brilliant light in a very dark place.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Mm. And what does that say to you, Dr. Badger?
That there is light within darkness.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it sounds like that's got quite a strong resonance for you.
Very much so.
Light within darkness. Yeah.
I think it's interesting on the dark literary references. I'm thinking about Dracula and werewolves.
Yeah.
And also the way we sort of, it's like a psychological mirror of the moon. So we talk about the moon potentially changing the way we defend, of course,
and
controls the tides.
Yeah.
So it's far more dramatic and exciting than the sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the way it stimulates these sort of, I mean, Dracula, for example, but then you take our literature, it's a fantastic novel.
Yeah.
Werewolves are still going strong.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? It's very sort of universal and abiding symbol, isn't it? Doesn't yeah. And again, that sort of mystery. Yeah. Anything else about the moon? It's a sort of receptivity, isn't it? Well, maybe you said it's reflect on the sun's light, so. You could almost say something like, what's often talked about is the feminine principle or the receptive, isn't it? The sun being more like the masculine principle, the active. So something about receptivity. So yes, I was thinking some similar things. I was thinking, well, yes, it's mysterious. It does light in darkness, but also it leaves some things in shadow as well. So it's that kind of light and darkness. And yes, we can look fully at it. And so it's interesting, this poem is about the moon, but I think the moon and moonlight is a good symbol for poetry itself, actually. Because I think poetry itself is, well, it invites you to make an imaginative leap into experience. It kind of hints, doesn't it? A poem doesn't directly tell you, but it kind of hints. It's helping you to kind of have an experience of your own. It's giving you a glimpse or a hint. Yes, it's not so much pointing at experience as hinting at it. But that doesn't mean it's less able to convey the truth. You could say that's it's more able to convey the truth by doing that. Yeah, that poetry is not speaking the language of concepts, but that makes it more true, as it were, rather than less true. Does that sort of make sense? Yeah. Same with the language of images. They're sort of more true because they. Why are they more true? Well, they speak to our imaginations. They don't speak the language of the literal, which is always going to be limited in a sense because it's always going to. I suppose the danger with the literal is we think we know it, whereas the poem always leaves us. There's always more to be discovered. If you had that experience with, it could be a poem, but it could be any work of art, a painting you love, a piece of music you love. So say with a poem, you might read it and reread it, or with a painting, you might, you know, go and see it in a gallery or so on again and again, or a piece of music you might listen to, and each time you discover something new, don't you? It doesn't exhaust itself. I suppose the greater it is as an artistic work, the more limitless it will be, the less it will be exhaustible. There'll always be something new to discover in it. Does that sort of resonate with people? Oh, so this is very, very, it's a very, very important to me it's a very, very important principle, and to me it's like, well, the same is true of the Dharma, you know, it can never be exhausted. As soon as we think we know it, it's not it. It's always got to be something that's drawing us on. And that's what poetry does. I'm trying to think whether I want to say more, so much I could say about poetry being a love of mine. It sort of answers something for us, doesn't it, poetry? When I was thinking about what I wanted to talk to you about tonight or share with you tonight, I suddenly remembered I used to work in a bookshop, and I remember one day a young woman came in quite a distressed state, and she was, I would say, it wouldn't be too strong to say she was desperate. She wanted to find a poem, a particular poem. You might know it, it's by W.H. Auden, and it begins, "Stop all the clocks, turn off the telephone." You know, and it's a poem, it's a lament, it's a poem because someone's died. I didn't ask her, but I imagined for this young woman someone had died, and she wanted this poem. You know, she wanted this poem, she had to find it, so we found it for her. And that's what happens, doesn't it? That's what we want when someone's died. I was thinking the two things are when we're in love and when someone's died. We want poetry, don't we? That's probably when we most strongly feel we want poetry. All the way, I was thinking, from you know, the very, very touching little rhymes people often write, and, you know, in our local newspapers, often very kind of, I often find them very touching, like little sort of ditties people write to someone who's died, but obviously very, very heartfelt. So all the way from that to the you know, great poets like Auden and so on, we want poetry at a death. And when we're in love as well, it can't be put into words, so we perhaps might try and write a poem or find a poem to try and express that. Philip Larkin, the poet, he talks about the hunger in ourselves, the hunger in oneself to be more serious, that poetry kind of can meet that. So poetry itself, so something about the moon and poetry itself, I feel are resonant. So I started off by talking about, well, how can the Dharma life be the whole of our life? Maybe even calling the Dharma life is sort of too prescriptive. How can the whole of our life be a meaningful life, rather than we have our life, all too often we have our life and we have little pockets of meaningful bits, you know, in it, like there's our life and then, oh, we had a meaningful conversation last week, or I don't know, a meaningful thing happened here, you know. How can we have it not that way around, but the other way around? So the whole of our life is a meaningful life, a life lived, a life of value. That's the whole of our life, and our activity takes place within that, rather than the other way around. To me, that's the quest. And that means that we can't... How are we going to integrate everything into our life? It means we're not going to be able to have bits that we leave out and we think, oh, if I'm going to have a meaningful life, I can't have this in it. That will just have to stay over here. And I think, well, this, as I say, was the question very much for Sankaracharya. He, of course, wanted his Dharma life, his Buddhist life, but he for ages felt that he couldn't include this whole poetic world, the whole world of passion, of beauty, that somehow that was in a separate bubble over here. There was one sort of bubble, as it were, that was his Dharma life, and this was the separate bubble. And this is that was his work. I mean, how do you do this work? You can't. It's not work like digging a road or something. It's kind of deep work. How are you going to do this integration? And so with Sangharakshita's work, and I think very much for myself, it feels like my work. I don't always reveal more than I mean to reveal in these talks, but I was seeing someone I'm having some counselling with this morning, who's a Buddhist as well, and he said, "Well, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Oh, I'm giving a talk about Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2. He said, "That's a good subject for you, Subhadramaji." That's good. But of course, you know, he meant, you know, I think it's all our work. So I'm hoping, that's why, as I keep saying, I'm hoping this isn't so much me giving a biography of Sangharakshita, although it includes that. I'm hoping that this is all our work. I think all of us probably feel, yes, we want to, we must feel to some extent we at least want to meditate or we wouldn't be here. Perhaps we want to live a Buddhist life, but there'll be for all of us bits we think don't fit in. And what are we going to do with them? And particularly in Sangharakshita's case, it was this artistic, the dreamer, the poet, the moonlight that he felt couldn't fit in. And it's been a theme through all his teaching as he's gradually learned to the integration of those. It's meant that how he's then presented the Dharma when he later on came to teach in the West is a Dharma that includes passion. It's a Dharma that includes beauty. And I very much value that and try and remember not to take it for granted, even though in a sense it's all I've known because I've only known this Dharma, as it were. But try and remember not to take that for granted, because I don't really think I'd manage if I was trying to practice a Dharma without beauty, without the inclusion of the passions, without the inclusion of the dreamer in it. So let me just tell you a little bit more about this subject. From the words of Sangharakshita. So this is from a lecture he gave in 1976. It's called the Greater Mandala, and it's sometimes, interestingly enough, called sort of paraphrase the Greater Mandala of Uselessness, which makes me think of what you said about the moon. I'm just going to read you a few little sections from this and see if you've got any responses. So he starts off, one of the first things he says, the enlightenment of the Buddha was not a cold, detached knowledge. He saw with warmth, he saw with feeling. And he says, what is more, he saw everything as being pure or shubha, which also means beautiful. So the Buddha saw everything as pure beauty because he saw everything with compassion. Just as conversely, when you hate someone, they appear ugly. I know that quite well, the other side of it. It's true, isn't it? When we're in that state of hatefulness towards somebody, the world appears ugly. But conversely, when we're in a state of metta, we see the beauty. So he goes on to say that the bodhisattva, or you could do an enlightened being. So when I'm saying bodhisattva, I mean enlightened being. The bodhisattva's wisdom, in the fullest sense, therefore, you know, includes metta and seeing of beauty. So he goes on to say, and again, this ties in with what some of you were saying earlier when we were talking about the moon and the moonlight. He says, if all we see is the utilitarian value of things, and by things that includes people as well, then what we're basically doing is we're basically relating to that thing or that person from a need, which quite quickly becomes desire, which quite quickly turns into craving. So we don't see things or even people as existing in our own right, their own right. So he gives an example in the lecture of, you know, we might see a tree, but we might think, oh, that that would be really good for firewood or something, you know. So we can very often be in that utilitarian mode. Do people recognise that sort of utilitarian mode? We see things for what we can get from them, even subtly. You know, I know we all like to think we're nice and we don't do that, mm-hmm. but I think if we examine ourselves quite closely, and think even with people, we can, there can be a subtle thing of, well, what can I, what, you know, what's in it for me? Yeah, there can be a subtle what's in it for me, or a gross what's in it for me. Yeah, so we see things not completely as existing in their own right, but something to fulfill our own need. But for an enlightened being, for a bodhisattva, they wouldn't have that. Yeah, they wouldn't have that. There would be the enlightened being would just see things in their own right. Yeah, the enlightened being, the bodhisattva, wouldn't have. They'd be sort of empty of that desire to use things for any particular purpose. So all that would be left would be aesthetic appreciation. I think that's rather lovely, isn't it? That all that would be left would be the aesthetic appreciation, would be that sort of moonlight sense. And he says, so if you're an enlightened being, a bodhisattva, you'd enjoy the world much as you enjoy a work of art, which I also think is rather lovely. And again, it sort of, this ties in with what I was kind of talking about earlier, about how we see our lives. So he says that the bodhisattva, through their response to a world that's aesthetic and appreciative rather than utilitarian, kind of, it's like they create what we call a mandala, like a sort of pattern of the world. And he says, yes, so fair enough, to sustain life, we have to engage in a certain amount of practical activity. We have to, you know, think about things and understand how the world works. But if for an enlightened being, all this would take place in an overall context of aesthetic appreciation. And again, he says, we usually think of that aesthetic appreciation as a little corner, separate part of our life, within a much larger area that's all the utilitarian stuff, but really it needs to be the other way around. He says our overall attitude, our overall response to life should be purely aesthetic. We can think of ourselves as living within this sort of great mandala or pattern of aesthetic appreciation, and all our sort of practical affairs can take place within that, yeah? So he says the real values are aesthetic rather than utilitarian. But then it's very, very interesting. It's very, very, just like in a sense, the way the Buddha himself teaches. I like the way Sangharaksha teaches, because just when you think he's saying one thing, he does a little corrective, and this is what he does here. So he says, look, he's not talking about just a sort of navel-gazing ideal here. It's not just about, all, you know, just going into this dream world of aestheticism. He says, actually, the bodhisattva is working for the benefit of all beings, is actually the greatest worker of all, responding to the needs of beings and the situation all the time. But at the same time, he or she operates in this mandala. So it's not one or the other. So it's, they're not absenting themselves from this mandala of aesthetic appreciation, but they're, all the activity is an expression of the values of that. So in a sense, the bodhisattva has transcended the two extremes. So one extreme would be to be so immersed in practical activity that you totally identify with that and become really hassled and sort of worried and stressed and so on, sort of losing sight of the wider horizon of aesthetic appreciation that we get when we go back on retreat again. But the other extreme is we sort of lose ourselves in a sort of spaced out, maybe sort of vaguely positive state where we can't get anything done. Yeah, do people recognise that as well? You can go to that other extreme. But the ideal is the middle way. And just to kind of remind us that when we talk about the middle way in Buddhism, we're not talking about a midway, halfway house point. It's not like the middle way isn't just a sort of balance between two extremes. It's not like we've got this utilitarian thing on the one hand, getting stressed and hassled, and then we've got the sort of spacing out on the other hand. The middle way isn't just a bit of this and a bit of that. The middle way is something that's over and above both, so that's why we call it something that transcends. And the last little bit that I really love, the last few sentences, is, and this I think is key, he says that the bodhisattva does useful things, but he or she enjoys them. And that's why it said that the bodhisattva, an enlightened being, actually plays. So they're helping all beings and saving all beings, but it isn't sort of, it isn't stressful. It isn't kind of, they're like playing. They're like just coursing from one activity to the next. And that the difference between work and play is that play isn't necessary. It's not harnessed to any goal. It doesn't serve any purpose. He says, you can live without the art. So no one ever dropped dead from lack of art. It's quite superfluous. That's why it's so necessary. So that really reminds me of what you were saying about the moonlight. Yes, in a sense it's true, isn't it? We could, I think, live without the moon, I think. I don't know what would happen to the tides. We couldn't live without the sun. I think possibly we could live without the moon. That might not be scientifically true, but we definitely couldn't live without the sun. I think possibly we could live without the moon. I don't think life is dependent on the moon. But yeah, maybe even just trying to imagine that would definitely be a lag, you know, hearing what you said so lyrically about that light and darkness, and yeah, to live without the moon, even to live without those werewolves, you know, that's quite a thought, isn't it? It's even if it does turn out to be useless, it's sort of necessary to us. And then it's interesting, so he takes it one step further, this thing about uselessness. And he says we can apply it to ourselves. And this is, again, my favourite bit, which I'm sure I've said at this class before. He says you don't have to justify your existence by being useful. You yourself are the justification for your existence. So maybe even if you only remember one thing, I think that's quite a good thing to remember. So what I've done, and there'll be a chance for some responses in a minute, is kind of taken you through Sangharakshita's journey of this Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2, this intense conflict. And what he did was he, as with any conflict, the thing to do is to up the tension. So he upped the tension of both. He upped the tension of his Dharma practice. He upped the tension of his poetry writing and exploration of beauty until there was a sort of explosion, and that was the middle way, and that meant he could present the teachings of the Dharma to us in a particular way that didn't exclude the beauty, that didn't exclude, well, the whole sort of appreciation of the art that's particularly emphasised in Sri Ratna. There is a particular emphasis, and one that I try and remember not to take for granted. It's interesting. I remember years ago having a friend who's a poet, and he was trying to choose between Sri Ratna and another Buddhist order to be ordained in. And if he had chosen the other order, I can't remember which one it was, but what he told me was he would not have been able to write poetry anymore. So that particular order didn't include poetry. I'm sure for also cogent reasons, but I feel lucky to be in this entry right now, which does include that. Not just because I think, oh good, I can go to a gallery, I can write poems, but because I think it has got something to say about the nature of the Dharma life itself, this thing about the way poetry is always giving you this hint, this glimpse, and always drawing you on, and there's always more to be discovered. I think that's the nature of the Dharma itself. So I think it's saying something about that, and that's the integration. So let me stop there, because I want to leave us a little bit of time. We've got about 10 minutes or so there for any questions, responses, disagreements, reflections, questions. Yes, ma'am.
You suggested that the way of dealing with this kind of conflict is to up the tension.
Ah, yes.
Could that potentially be risky also?
Okay, so what would be at risk?
Not sleeping enough.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sleeping myself, it will be the risks.
Okay, know? Okay.
Getting really exhausted, and I don't know. Or maybe just like, I suppose just wearing thin or wearing yourself out. And maybe that's what you need to do.
Okay, no, hang on a minute. I don't want to like, don't want to send Matt to an early grave.
It's okay. I mean, we're speaking generally, not necessarily specifically
about me. Well, maybe it depends. I'm just thinking as I speak here. Maybe it depends what tension you're up on, if you see what I mean. Because it sounds like you're. Like, if you need to sleep, so that's got to also be part of it. Do you know what I mean? That's also, maybe when I'm talking about upping the tension, I'm talking about not ignoring one part of ourselves. So if you're sort of ignoring the part of yourself that needs to sleep, that then needs to be included. I think this is just off the top of my head.
So you're talking about kind of.
So you're not trying to sort of drive yourself crazy by going tension, tension, tension more. You're trying to be more inclusive. But maybe what I'm trying to say, what not to do, is just to settle for something mediocre. Just to think, oh, this is too much. I can't work out whether I'm meant to be practicing the Dharma, writing poetry. I'll tell you what, I'll just. Give both of them up and that'll solve the problem. Do you see what I mean? So not to collapse into something mediocre to save yourself the trouble of having to worry about it. Or just letting one side win, in a sense, just going, okay, I tell you what, well, in the case of Sangharajita, he was in danger of letting the Sangharajita one side win when he burned the poems, but luckily that had a shock to his system. So that's what not to do. And maybe that, I don't know if that helps. That's what I'm thinking, not to do. Not to go to mediocre, or not just to sort of swing to one side, because that'll seem like it solves it. And I think it's, this is class. There'll always be these tensions in all different things in our Dharma life. Classic tension between, self and other. Should I work on my meditation before I help other people, or should I help other people and then that'll help, then go deeper in my meditation? You'll always have those, there'll always be tensions, but sort of you're trying to keep them in creative tension. Maybe that's a better way of putting it, rather than upping the tension. Try and keep a creative tension. But that's got to include sort of looking after yourself. That's in the creative tension. If you see what I mean.
That's
helpful. Yeah, good. Good. Okay.
I think,
yes.
The tension and what's been coming to mind for me when you were talking about Sangharajita 1 and 2 was actually the archetypes that I've been reading about in terms of the maturing of masculine and feminine.
Yeah.
The king who gives the overall direction and which sounds related to the Dharma. Sangharajita 1, and then magician, or the lover,
Sangharajita 2,
healing, connection,
art.
And when you were saying about creative, bring things together, the magician as well, binding the two and looking after yourself.
Yeah.
So I think, the archetypes
Yes.
And maturing those in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like it kind of is a template that could apply
yeah.
to you as well.
Yeah, yeah. It would, and they form this harmonious pattern, mm-hmm. don't they? And temperamentally we'll tend to be pulled more to one and the others will be weaker, but to be a sort of whole person, yeah, is developing them all, yeah. That's good, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm. Anything else?
I think it's something about using the energy of both. It sounds like, rather than like, so there's this way of having a Dharma life, so saying what's to one and two, this, he wants to have a Dharma life,
yeah.
and that's his priority.
Yeah.
He thinks initially that the poetic and creative and kind of social
yeah.
aspects of himself isn't part of Dharma.
Yeah, yeah.
And then finally realizes that one is kind of inherent in the other.
Yeah.
So I think it's something about, for me, it's something about trying to trust my instincts, that the things that I want to do, that I'm drawn to, that aren't on the surface my kind of like spiritually ideal life.
Yeah.
There's a reason why I want them.
Yeah,
that's
yes.
real value.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I need to sort of somehow
yeah.
turn the energy I put into them. So, for example, the way you can try and look for pleasure in your meditation
yeah.
practice
yeah.
rather than get distracted by other more
yeah.
pleasures.
Yeah.
But you've got
yeah.
to have pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't not have it.
Yeah.
You can't just give it up.
Yeah.
So there's something about that. And
yeah.
So now I'm nervous of the same thing you are, Matt, about like the heart, because it's a bit too work hard, play hard. Like
I see, yeah.
If I misunderstand creative tension to meaning like, you know, practice harder and work harder and just never sleep again.
Right.
Yeah.
Live a full-time Dharma life and live
yeah.
a full-time, like
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
material life, because that's
yeah.
necessary.
Yeah.
And just burn out of, you know.
Yeah,
out.
Yeah. Okay, no, that's good.
Find a way.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's good. So yeah, I'm glad you're saying that. Yes, because it's not work hard, play hard. Yeah, so because that's a bit compensatory, isn't it? So that's so maybe creative tension.
I think it is. There is the same way the story is all about. He finds a way to use this urge for creativity and beauty for the purposes of Dharma life. And it's, in fact, it's necessary to it.
Yeah.
That beautiful line about the sage being the best poet.
Yeah.
Person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he sees that the way he was seeing it was flawed.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that binary way.
Yeah. Yeah. There is, but and somehow I imagine it. Somehow I've got these little circles in my mind. The little circle of Sangharakshita 1, Sangharakshita 2 is quite small circles, but when they come together, they mutually feed each other. And I think that's why it is different from the work hard, play hard that are compensating each other.
Mm-hmm.
Neither are satisfactory, but this is they're both lighting each other up. And that's what he discovered. Well, that's where we've got this image, the moonlight and the moon. Yeah. 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 And I think what you're saying as well, Sal, that's when we find a part of us that seems to be that we're keeping it in a separate compartment from our meaningful life or our Dharma life. It's really explore that of what does that mean for me? It's trying to go under, trying to find the meaning of that. And yeah, being very, very careful of prematurely dismissing that. I think that's what we can do. I think it is a particular danger for so-called spiritual practitioners, that we can quite quickly start to go, no, that's not spiritual, that's not spiritual. It's a particular danger to us, in a way, that if you weren't practicing, you wouldn't really have that, because you wouldn't have anything to set it against. But instead of doing that, you try and find, well, what is that meaning for me? And you sort of start from where you are with that. And then, you know, maybe the work then is, yeah, sort of a work of refinement, transformation, but it's definitely not, it can't be shutting that out, because that's your very lifeblood and energy and fuel and the thing that's going to make your Dharma life, your real life, not just this sort of, as I've talked about here before, pretend life that's built on an idea, that's built on no foundation, that's going to be perhaps sustained for a little while, at a few years, but it's going to come toppling down about your ears. This work has got to be a bit more patient and slow and steady to build something on the real foundation of what really means something to you, which requires much more a kind of commitment and intelligence and sensitivity and self-knowledge and having good friends that can help you to remind you. It asks more of us, actually. We can't just rely on somebody else telling us what to do in a kind of crude fashion. We can't just go, okay, this is it, I'm off now, try and sort of shoot up to the stars. You know, we've got to bring our whole selves with us. Yeah.
Well, I find it interesting that you, in like what you were talking about, you're like still creating this sort of dichotomy between like the Dharma life and your material life. And I think like from what I got was that like actually there shouldn't be this like separation, or that there isn't, that there's still elements of the Dharma that I'm sure you could find like within the material life, and it's like not to regard it as two separate entities, but
to
try and like
bring it. So the whole thing is a process of integration.
Because even like in your material life, you have still made a lot of decisions, and I think if you can kind of like sometimes trace back to the decisions that you made, they might have been like spiritually motivated in a way that, so there is probably more element of like the spiritual side in the, what you're calling, like what you see as materialistic.
Well, it's you, and then it's seen as a whole, it's, at the end of the day, it's your life.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not that you've got, actually, you've not really got two lives, and it's not really the Sangharashtra. There really literally was Sangharashtra 1 and Sangharashtra 2, yeah. We better leave it there. So thank you. Next week, Kasha Mitra is going to share with us his inspiration, and I hope to see you then. Thank you.
Thank you.